Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you're watching and listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. Today, my special guests are Daniel and Derek DeStephen. I had the great good fortune of meeting the DeStephen brothers at the Full Disclosure Now conference back in July in St. Petersburg, Florida. Derek and I had some illuminating conversations. Derek and
Sweet.
Daniel's grandfather, Daniel Salter, was a member of the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit. I had first heard of the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit reading the classic book, UFO Crash at Aztec. I think I read about the IPU from other sources. I think Timothy Good and other researchers talked about it. But when I read that part about a specific unit set up by the Army, the U.S. Army at the time, under the direct orders of General George Marshall, who then became Secretary of State of the United States after World War II. Today, they're having a hallelujah breakdown because they found out Dick Cheney was some kind of big shot in the UFO program. But when I look at it from a historical standpoint, there was Eisenhower, there was General George Marshall. I mean, these were mega players on the world stage. Dick Cheney was just an evil bastard. It didn't really contribute anything to society and the human race. So when we go back and zoom out and look at the formation of the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit, which was part of the U.S. Army's Counterintelligence Science and Technological Directorate, and then we see that one of the first operational deployments of the IPU was at the UFO crash at Aztec, New Mexico, March 1948. Well, that's a lot of stuff to chew on right there. So, without any further ado, we'll bring Derek and Daniel in to tell their background because, again, they are the grandsons of an actual member of the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit, and also their grandfather also later joined the National Reconnaissance Office. And we've been hearing a lot of stuff about that also, but we can get more into that. So, without any further ado, Daniel and Derek, welcome to the Cosmic Switchboard Show.
Thank you for having us. Oh,
Well,
you're muted,
glad
Dan.
to be here. Thanks for having us. Yeah.
The pleasure is all mine. Well, tell us about how you came to be involved in this research, how you came across the information, because and also the fact that your grandfather, and you can talk a bit about this, was part of that initial whistleblowers conference that Stephen Greer, to his credit, I give credit where credit's due, Stephen Greer put that together many years ago. So please, the floor is yours. You guys, either one, and just interchange.
Yeah, that's kind of how it all started. We weren't aware of how involved our grandfather was with the UFO phenomenon in his military career until we found out that he was a part of the Disclosure Project. And we didn't even know he was a part of it until after the fact. And a couple years later, he came out with a book disclosing a lot of information called Life with a Cosmos Clearance. And so when we were growing up, it was probably the mid-90s when he first started talking about his involvement and his knowledge of UFOs and aliens and the history of what our government's been doing and so forth. And we were teenagers at the time, and we would go visit him out in New Mexico occasionally during the summertime. And he would for me, he disclosed a lot of really interesting information that I had never heard anyone talk about before, like interdimensional beings. He talked about Nazis down in Antarctica and atomic weapons testing down there. I mean, stuff that just blew my mind. Time travel and the whole like that we had this technology and the Philadelphia experiment. And so I didn't really tell anyone much about it. I kept it to myself because it was kind of seemed a little out there and I didn't know what to bank about it. I really, he had never talked to me about it before until the mid-90s, I think, when he felt safe that he could come forward or go public with some of the information that he had. And so I kind of just tucked it all away, and not until we found out he had this book come out in 2003, where he had a security level 38 levels above top secret, this Cosmos Clearance. That was just kind of jaw-dropping to see the amount of information that he put in that book about what he knew and what's been happening in the government and since the 1930s, even earlier than that. So that's where it all started, and that definitely sparked our curiosity. Unfortunately, after he wrote his book, his health was declining. He had a lot of little mini strokes and things like that, just really, we didn't get to communicate with him a lot about what we had in the book and about his testimonies from the Disclosure Project, which is unfortunate. So it's kind of been piqued our curiosity to really dive deep into, finding other information or other sources that back the things that he said, and see what truths are come out of all the information he had. Just kind of dissect that information over the last 20 or so years. That's kind of been our mission and our journey to keep that going. So Derek can add more to that, his experiences and.
I really, as far as getting a lot of verbal information from our grandfather, I think my brother got more of that, where it was, and even though we were still quite young, I think my brother retained a lot of it. But he, I mean, it's just so much that he was trying to pass on. And my brother being the oldest, maybe he felt like he needed to at least get one of somebody on that in that generation to know what would understand what's happening. But since I was a little younger, I would visit him every summer too, even more often. I think as I got older, I would still go out there and see him. But he didn't, by that time, he didn't really open up a lot because, and again, we didn't know until 2001, until I graduated high school, just how big he was and that he was a part of the Disclosure Project. I was actually taking my graduation photo with him at the house before he went up to DC with Dr. Greer and did that whole thing. So we didn't have enough knowledge beforehand to ask all the right questions when he was.
No, if it's just you, Derek, but let's get both frozen. Let's see.
Yeah, so and that's basically how it went down as far as his health declining, and by the time I really understood the knowledge that he had and grasped the implications of that, by the time I wanted to ask those questions, it was already too late. And I think he knew the gravity of what he had to share, even at the Disclosure Project, because he was the only witness to not. To not actually, when it was his time to go up to the podium and say what he had to say, and say, "I'm willing to testify before Congress under oath." He was the only one. As he got up to talk, he froze up. He just like really froze up, and even Dan Willis, who was there, and we spoke to about it, and he said that he just gave this like shrill and just like like terrified to say anything. I mean, so it showed that. What he had to share was even probably more, at least as mind-blowing and groundbreaking as Clifford Stone with his testimony about being a part of similar crash retrievals and being encountering the ETs and then also there's so many great ones that went to that first initial press club hearing. He was actually sitting behind Clifford Stone and Mark McCandlish at the time during that briefing, and we have a photo of him. As you can see, he's kind of looking a little bit more like he's obviously not in the best health at that time. But I can share some of those. I mean, I can share some slides about it if it
Yeah,
helps to go.
please, please. And just a quick comment, and I don't want to, spin too conspiratorial a cast about this, but I wonder if he was interfered with in some way, like beamed or something, or whatever the case may be, because his health was already in decline. But the way you describe his reaction, oh, please, yeah, take it away.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, and so I mean, this is just really to show you the kind of the order of in his life, as we know, is in the Air Force from 47 to 68, then reconnaissance office right after the year later, and till who knows when, we don't know. And there's no record we can really find on the NRO part of that about him. And then the 2001 Disclosure Project. And this is him here on the right, on the bottom, sitting behind Clifford Stone, And as Clifford's talking, he's still coherent. He's still understanding everything, of course, and what's happening. And so he's nodding his head as Clifford's talking about the at least 16 different ET species that we have, and a lot of the other like really groundbreaking stuff they're talking about. And I feel that for sure this conference has been overlooked by no accident. It's been completely just wiped away. Like we've never had people come up and give all this mind-blowing testimony. And in the past few years, that's like we're still dealing with these guys that are like, yeah, do UFOs, are they there? Do we know what they are? Do we have any? The Grush testimony, who's also NRO, obviously, and how he's taking it as non-human intelligence, and they're using all these other abbreviations and acronyms, and it's like, come on, guys, you don't have to reinvent the wheel here. We've done this for 75 plus years.
Yes.
So,
Now,
but
tell me about parts of the book that really intrigued you, because when your brother Daniel mentioned in the book, your grandfather talked about knowledge of this in the U.S. government as far back as the 1930s, at least. When, from your grandfather's perspective, did this timeline really kick into high gear?
I'd say that's about right, Dan. If you want to take some of that, but this is to the slide we kind of try to summarize in
Please,
that
please.
respect. Yeah, he traces a lot of it back to Germany in the occult societies there that were present and starting as early as like the 1920s, going into the 30s, that really got into some of this esoteric stuff, and a lot of scientists that became part of that working on. I don't know, their initial attempts were at time travel, but they eventually came around to electromagnetic propulsion, and the different technologies that they had back then were pretty advanced even at the early 30s. They had some wreckage from crashes in Brazil, according to our grandfather, in the Amazon jungle in 1931, 32. And they were able to back engineer some things. They came up with their whole line of the Hannibal craft and the RFC vehicles as well. And they had these Hannibal ones. I mean, they could go, all different directions, hover, anything you want. They really, tapped into that electromagnetic propulsion and were able to functionally use it very successfully. They had motherships, according to him, that could house some of these things that could be stationed out in the middle of space. They said that they potentially had a one-way mission to Mars with help from Japan back in 1942. So that whole decade of the 30s, they were prior to World War II. Their anti-gravity technology was coming together pretty exponentially based on the technology that they were able to retrieve. Yeah. And he was explaining, of course, he goes into the Thule, the Thrill Society, and Maria Orsic, and those what do you call it, the real Damen, the real women that would have the psychic abilities to be mediums for, they're basically the channels to other entities, whatever they might be. There's other books that have been written about that. Sean David Morton actually had in his series a book called The Vril Daman Diaries that was supposedly a real actual diary from the Austrian or German chant, whatever he was. He was a royalty of he owned his own castle, and basically they were working with the Maria and the women on their own craft away from the SS and away from that, trying to get as far as they could with it. Before, the SS came and tried to take what they could. But that was basically in the 20s, when they first started messing around with that stuff. And then the Nazi Bell also. Well, actually, I think our grandfather's mentioning experimental time machine before the Nazi Bell. He mentioned it in 1924 in Adensburg. So I'm not familiar as much with what that would have been, but apparently he saw files, or he knew with his clearance that that's also what they were doing. So So time travel is a big part of this. I mean, that's kind of like maybe it goes hand in hand depending on how advanced you get with the electromagnetic propulsion and you're going past the speed of light travel at some point into, different warp speed. He talks about warp speed and warp drive and those capabilities. So you're obviously going faster than speed of light once you get to that high advanced of the tech. So it's yeah, there's a lot of different avenues he went in the book, and he really tried to. He spent a good amount of time talking about Germany, talking about the Brotherhood lodges, the Black Sun, and all the fact that they were basically what Indiana Jones, the whole story of Indiana Jones. They were just picking up little bits of what they were truly doing, looking for all the ancient artifacts, and even down to like the Spear of Destiny and things like that. Some of the more esoteric symbols and things. So anyway, that's one aspect of the book. And if you want to talk about, you were trying to,
He
you were mentioning
talks
about,
about.
yeah, go ahead, Dan.
I'm just as far as like the technology development. He would said, a lot of the stuff with Project Paperclip, the Russians and the U.S., took the scientists and started to develop the technology for themselves. And he said that the U.S. in general was about 10 years behind anything that the Germans were doing at the time. This was kind of his how he framed it. Go ahead, Derek. I was just going to close that.
Yeah, exactly. Before I jump into that, we could talk about just the origins of the IPU or how he mentions it. I mean, he kind of just mentioned it offhand that yeah, he was a part of it. And actually, the one piece of evidence that we have, the most tangible, I guess you could say, even though we no longer have that license plate, but it was a fact that he got a license plate with that. That whole label of the name on there, so I can show you that. But
Pretty
the
ballsy thing
only
to do.
he just had it on his van, and I think he must have had. We found out he must have had at least two of those, apparently, because he had it in Taos, and then he gave one to him, our father as a wedding gift. But
It was on the van that he gave our father. Yeah.
Yeah, the license plate was on the van he gave our father. Anyway, I before I get to that, the only other thing I can tell you about when we were young that I didn't mention was it was oh my God. Okay, here we go. It was just us as kids, but he came to our house in Virginia about when we were about this age. I think that was the trip he probably came, and he told us I was about 10, I believe. And he said, my mom said, I want you guys to gather around the table, the dining room table. Your grandfather has something to tell you. And that's when he first shared his first sighting of a UFO back in 1949. And he didn't, I don't think he went into great detail. We're just kids, but he wanted to share that story. And he was felt like that was now the time that they were able to start speaking out. Like it was okay to come out about this because by that time, it had been at least 40 plus years, and I'm not sure what you're supposed to keep your oath for somewhere between what 40 to 50 years. I was somewhere in there. He felt at that time it was long overdue. It's about time that he starts, being open about it. And basically ever since that time, and that's when he was moving to Taos, that's when he really started to open up and really get into communities and smaller circles and start discussing all these topics and revealing this information. So that was just interesting. But about the license plate, let me find that. This is at least the stamp that we always like to go back and refer to because it has that same message. It's basically what the license plate has: Interplanetary Phenomenon, Scientific and Technical Counterintelligence Unit, and it has that WA-25DC on it. So that stamp, I actually still have it. I got it from the storage, and he put that on all the documents that he collected over the years, and said, I'm giving this my stamp of authenticity. I'm saying this is true. This is information that the public needs to know, and that I've seen in the files or seen in his line of work, however long he had been working in this in the field. So this is just the MJ-12, of course. So he's validating the MJ-12 documents in some ways, and this is just one of them. The memorandum to for the president, I believe it was Marshall. Actually, that's Marshall's, like you were saying, Secretary Marshall, who was involved with the IPU. He's telling the president we need to start taking this seriously. I think Twining needs to be informed, all this kind of thing. General Twining. But this the license plate's here we go. So, and this led me down this rabbit hole. And James, I don't know if did you catch the presentation? This is the presentation, but the one that we were doing in Florida in July, this past July. Yeah. So a lot of this was in it. You know, and I don't know how many people actually got to see it. Unfortunately, the video recording of it didn't have any of our slides. So we're working on getting an edited version where you're going to see us speaking and you're going to see the slides. But before that, I mean, hopefully in the next few weeks it'll be out, but at least you're getting able to see it a little bit of it here. And that's the plate down his Suburban that he had in Taos. And I remember that. I remember seeing it. I mean, it was kind of interesting. And maybe he, I don't know if he had it on all the time. I don't think he was too worried about it. But the reason why I say he must have had two is because our father had it on the van that he was given as a wedding present. And they called it the boogie van. It was a very ugly brown, like brown old looking van, like the Scooby-Doo kind of van with the curtains and all that and captain's chairs and everything. But anyway, he was going, our father's a civil engineer and he was going to one of the naval stations. He thinks it was likely Langley down near Norfolk. He was going onto the base because he had to deliver or have, he wanted to have some discussion about, you know, whatever the contract is they're working on. They worked on some of the military bases and everything. So his coworkers were all like, well, it's going to take an act of God for you to get on that base. You're going to be sitting there with security for at least an hour, probably. You know, they're going to be asking all sorts of questions. So they're like, good luck with that. So when he goes there with the van, the security guy just waves him right through. And he was just like, what? I don't understand. But he just went and had his meeting. He thought about it, but just went to the meeting and just pretended it was normal, I guess. And then when he was leaving the base, he stopped by the security guy and asked him, why did you just wave me through? And he pointed down at the van and it's just like, that's all you need. Yeah. So it's very interesting.
That is interesting. And, a quick point about the Germans. One advantage, a great advantage they had is that they were steeped in the ether physics, whereas in the West, the gradual slide into reductionism, particles, subparticles, etc., the Germans were already working at the etheric level. And so they had no qualms about merging the mystical with the scientific. That was part of the deal. And the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit, according to the book UFO Crash at Aztec, Aztec was one of the first and most successful of their deployments because they had the fiasco that was Roswell, right?
Yeah.
And they didn't want to go through that again. So the New Mexico Aztec crash retrieval has to stand as one of the most successful, and the efforts they made at covering it up too, destroying people's livelihoods, destroying people's characters, and suing them in court, what have you. It's they took it really seriously. But anyway, about the IPU, what else did you glean from the book and what little you got from your father? Because it looks to me as if he decided the way the wind was blowing, because the National Security Act, the Air Force split off from the Army. Clearly, he made the right choice. He thought, I'm going to stay with these guys because I'm more likely to be staying involved in UFO type activities. So, I just want to throw
Right.
that out.
Yeah, I mean, I think we did like a summary slide here to try to understand or just summarize what happened in 47 because so much happened. And like you're mentioning, the Air Force, it was the Army Air Force up until just right around Roswell time. Like he actually enlisted in June of 1947, and within a few weeks from that's when Roswell started, and that's when it occurred. And then all these start of security acts and memorandums start to come out, and CIA was created at the same day of the Air Force being created, right? Which is kind of just, it kind of shows you what their mindset was, or what's the rationale there. Like, this whole other intelligence division has to be created along with the Air Force, and how they were tied together, in one way or another. It's interesting. And the National Security Council, those types of things as well. We know the big players like Alan Dulles, who had all ties, sorts of ties to the Nazis, and was a big, obviously, supporter. What do you call him? When they're obviously making deals one way or another. But he got all the information from the OSS during the war that ended up going to the CIA, right? And in between that time, so I did a lot of digging to just figure out what's going on here. Like I said, our grandfather didn't say much other than I was a part of that group in the book. He said also, while he was also a part of Project Blue Book, right, which was just the smokescreen, just the way of telling the public, yeah, we're looking into it. We're not seeing anything, trying to debunk everything with Mr. Hynek. And our grandfather said he became friends with Hynek. But even at the time of the first sightings that he saw with his crew during, because he was a radar specialist, and they worked on high powered radar and more of the advanced stuff apparently. But he said, like, at that time he was like, yeah, I know what, well, we're seeing this UFO. Well, then he says to his crew, what do you think Hynek's going to say about this? They're going to come up with all these things, like it's swamp gas, or we're delusional. We're going to lose our jobs. Like, we don't want to cause all this, attention, too much attention to us by saying all this. But at the end of the day, because he had a couple of these sightings so early on in his career, and he was working, somehow he got involved. He claimed to have been working under Benoit Mandelbrot. Of course, we know who made the Mandelbrot set and the whole idea of fractal geometry and all those things. This that goes kind of into, I think he, I'm pretty sure that must have been tied to particleization at the end of the day. And that's probably because they were working on that. Our grandfather claimed that's also one of the things he started to be involved with, not just the alien topic, not just UFOs and the extraterrestrial issue, but at a certain level you talk about particleization, and that has to do with time travel. That's the whole aspect of it. So it's bringing that technology and figuring out how to use it on that fundamental level that probably the Nazis had a way more advanced knowledge than we have. And like you said, using the ether and knowing all those parts of physics that we're just now catching up back up to where we should have already been a long time ago. So I went off a tangent on that, but that's kind of how he started to get involved, working under Benoit Mandelbrot, and just asking questions, and he just was curious. And so they just slowly said, wow, you seem to know a lot more, or you seem to be really interested for one, and you're we can either bring you in or we can try to make you quiet. And so apparently they decided he might be useful, but he had to go through all this background checks. He said it took, in the video, while he was still quite present, back in the late 90s, he was explaining that it was just the most rigorous amount of testing he's ever been. But, even the mental testing and the psychological, the philosophical, his the theosophy, all sorts of questions about how would you react in this situation? Because obviously you're going to be dealing with other beings. You're gonna, if you see an alien, are you gonna freak out? Are you gonna be okay? Like, they're basically asking those questions. But so anyway, he passed the test. He said only him and a handful of guys, less than five guys, that were able to go into this at the time. And this would have been early 50s when that happened. So that's kind of how he got led into it.
And he
So I
had his
guess.
cryptographic clearance.
Right. And he claimed that he was a Conrad courier for Eisenhower. So he had access to the war codes. He was one of the guys that carried the case, and there'd be two guys with the same codes, or at least two guys, and you'd have to, you have to have the right code in order to pass it along and for the president to.
That was the what they call the football you're referring to, the nuclear
Yeah,
launch codes.
exactly. And you hear that thrown around nowadays too a lot with who's really carrying the codes, and did Trump always have that the whole time Biden was president or not? They should probably did. Who knows? But anyway, he said he had that clearance, which means you have to have a Q clearance. If you're holding on to anything nuclear in that regard, that means you're up there at Q clearance already. And that's interesting too, that we tried to put this together. Now, this wasn't from our grandfather. It was just online. I'm sure you've probably seen it circulating online, but to try to show these levels that at the highest level, and how these are interrelate to each other. I'm sure they kind of overlap each other and mingle with each other, because our grandfather said, in the Disclosure Project 2001, even Dr. Greer says he had a cosmic clearance as what he stated, but his book says cosmos. And then come to find out, we're talking to other insiders or people that independent sources, and they're claiming that he had a majestic level. And we'll even talk to about another story about a medium that we're talking with now, that she just has a gift, and she's actually in contact with her grandfather. But the majestic comes up a lot whenever she's getting information in. So,
Yeah, and you'll see a lot of those majestic documents are stamped with ultra on there, one of the other levels there. So it seems like there's different interminglings there. Well,
right,
then
and
it's
ultra,
definitely
yeah.
compartmentalized, but the IPU, and then later with this involvement with the NRO, in one of the cover names for the NRO in the early days, in the late 50s, was the Special Activities Office, but it was really the National Reconnaissance Office. And there had to be some ability in his role to intermingle, so to speak, with a variety of different high-level agencies. Because if you just look back at that IPU report, right, they were talking about the Atomic Energy Commission, the Air Force Intelligence, the FBI. I mean, he was like intermingling it, and IPU had their hands in all these different pots. They would have had to, but please continue.
Right, right. I'm just kind of sifting through the documents here too to see if anything comes back to the IPU. But as you said, like he's basically saying that the Star Wars and all that initiative, that was all NRO type of the agency that was so secret it didn't exist, and you didn't name the NRO up until like the late 90s, I think, when they finally mentioned that name. But he talks a little bit about that, and about he had this chart, the Star Wars City map, to kind of outline how all these mingle together. And as you can see, NRO's up here with the president, and with Magi, the Magi clearance level, and how they interact with these other levels, the NSA, National Security Council, Director of Central Intelligence, and CIA, obviously. The 1010 squadron, he talked about them a lot, and how they would get filter information in and out from them. And then the Wackenut assassins and all those ones that would take people out for talking and speaking out about it. So he claimed also that he was part of that, those groups of people. I mean, you call them the Men in Black. Maybe back in the day, they were actually just that. They were just Men in Black. Maybe it's changed now, but they were these teams, and he was one of the first teams to try to tell people just to be quiet. You didn't, basically say you didn't see that, it was your imagination. Just don't, it's better just not to talk about it. But he would do it in a non-threatening way. But then you'd have a second team. If that didn't work, they'd come in and start to threaten you and your family. And then by that time, if you didn't be quiet, the third team would take you out. They were the assassins. So he did say that is a very serious thing. And if he knows that's all going in the background, I'm sure that's probably why he was probably freezing up in 2001. He's like, this stuff still goes on. It's not like it's, I can't, he's not going to be like, Dr. Greer is going to protect me. Like he
So
knew.
yeah,
No
we
way.
saw the invitation in our storage from Dr. Greer to our grandfather for the Disclosure Project in 2001, and there was like a whole 3 day, 3 to 4 day event, and we had activities going on. And he called my mom in the middle of it after the, he froze up and told her, "You need to get me out of here. I have to leave." Like he did not feel comfortably in there for the rest of the duration.
Just a quick comment of, and by saying this, I'm not marginalizing at all the brave individuals that took part in that historic conference. My friend Larry Warren was there talking about his encounter with aliens at
Right,
Rendlesham.
right.
But your grandfather potentially had all a lot of the pieces put together. So I
Yeah.
can see why they would be very worried about him putting this out, because prior to the advent of him and his book, we had bits and pieces. We had the crash retrieval testimony, and then other people would report seeing bodies or technology in certain secret locations, what have you. But as far as like an organizational chart, a table of organization, or order of battle, if you will, yeah, your grandfather probably had a lot of it in his head.
Yeah. And it's interesting you just said that, like a lot of it was in his head, because I think, and you have to with that, when you have that much, and if it's that much of a security breach and danger of just speaking about it, we looked through his files and we had found a lot of stuff that he researched and looked out throughout the years. And like you said, he would stamp it and say, you know, I'm probably saying, I've seen that. If I've seen the original document, I probably helped write that document. Like we're starting to think that maybe he had a say in this MJ-12 operations manual based on the testimony we've heard or other corroborating evidence we've heard. So, and because it also, it has these little hints in it about, you know, it has the Washington 25 DC and these ties to other documents we're gonna look at too. But now
And I
there's all this
think,
controversy over this one, but yeah.
yeah, and
Go
I think
ahead.
a lot of he probably there's a lot of information he did not put in his book, out of caution, for his life and for, our family, actually. He says in his book he was very good friends with Phil Schneider and William Cooper, and he was aware of what happens when you say too much, and I think that's probably why there was not a lot more in his book that he didn't disclose, in 2003.
And that's a good point, because Nancy Red Star was, she's a Native American who helped, basically she transcribed what he said, put all of what his information was and put it into that book. So maybe there's some of her take on it or way if she wanted to way she wanted to get it out, but it's still, it's basically his knowledge and what he had to share. But she also said that he definitely had more that he knew, and that he only felt comfortable saying so much. And that's corroborated with other sources. Now, we've used a few different sources from all the backgrounds, but like even the some are mediums, some are channelers. They also said there's only a small percentage of what he actually discussed that he actually knew. And then if you want to get into the aspect of who else we've contacted, do you know Peter the Insider, the ACIO group,
Yeah,
and that.
I've listened to some of his talks, yeah.
Yeah, and it's a little hard to make of what if how much Peter is saying is who he is, and I mean we can never know, because we don't really know, we don't see an inch of him. But Jessica Morocco, she's very seems very credible and seems to take him for his word, and has worked alongside with him for many years now, and that's how we got in touch with Peter. And Peter's claimed that, yeah, grandfather definitely had clearances, even into the ACIO, that he was actually involved. And that can be corroborated by Will Nutter. But Will Nutter, or Johann Fritz, as he's termed in the secret space program, they don't have any ties together. I got to make that clear. The ACIO and Will Nutter, they're not associated in any way. But Will Nutter was able to see and pull from those files that he has access to. From his altar, that he's been able to somehow get those files. But that's probably the most, what would you say, Dan, the most the amount of information that's as in
The
that we
most
can
detailed,
capture.
comprehensive
Exactly.
information that he had access to
And
somehow. It was amazing, yeah.
it all corroborates what Peter the Insider is saying, and what these other people have been saying, and even this anonymous person that maybe we'll be able to reveal at some point. But this person has been spot on. But I mean, it's just amazing how all these people, there's a lot that starts to to validate, to corroborate the information. And I put together slides that basically show that, and asking,
Yeah,
I
and these
guess.
other sources are more like the clairvoyant, remote viewing medium type people. Yeah.
Right. And I guess the one that we thought summed it up the best with the information that all started to corroborate, we put it into this, what this person was claiming or what was saying, and who has was directly contacting with him at the time that he was involved with the alien crashes or crash crete craft, that he had been, he'd seen the technology, had seen the craft, he'd actually been, exchanging information and interacting with the ETs themselves. And that's also what Will Nutter had claimed when it came to what he had access to. It just goes down a big rabbit hole when you look at it. And so we're trying to take all the little pieces of information and figure out, what makes sense of it. That he said there was a lot of pressure to figure out the ET tech at the time back in the 50s. So there was the pressure to basically make the deal with whoever it was. And that's the MJ-12 kind of deal to say, we'll let you take some of humans, you'll and abduct a certain number of them, as long as you return them unharmed and as long as you wipe their minds so they won't remember anything. That was kind of the deal, right? But that didn't go so well, and we've seen where that's taken us all these years
Holding the
later.
short end of the stick for sure, because there was nothing they could have done to stop the ETs from abducting people anyway. So it was like they were happy to accept the scraps from the table, so to speak. Did
Right.
your grandfather in these and from this intelligence source here, did he ever talk about the Germanic Nordic ET connection? Did that come up as part of the discussion? Because
Andy.
it seems to me that they're, well, at least one of the races that they're interacting with, and for some time have been interacting with, is this Nordic ET race. And I happen to see, it could have been a hybrid or it could have been a full-on Nordic malevolent ET, but it was rolled out of the hangar, so to speak, to intimidate me in particular with its psychic abilities and, all this other stuff. So I'm just wondering, how that relationship with one or more ET races developed. If you're still in comms with that remote viewer, I'd love to pass on a few questions if you'll allow me, but please continue.
Yeah, we could probably do that. But Dan, there's also, we were going to say with me, the medium Dina, who we're still in contact with, she's constantly feeding us information and sort of these downloads, and he's almost like he's always there with her when there's a message that needs to come through. But he's been talking about Antarctica lately a lot. He has talked about these kind of like the Nordics or Pleiadians, and that's come up quite a bit. The Nordics have come up. So into what context and how it's related, it's hard to tell sometimes, but we know that there's a lot of involvement. A lot of it's in Antarctica right now, going on probably as we speak. And there's the good and the bad of every race. We can't say one's all good and one's all bad. So it becomes very convoluted and hard to figure out exactly how it's working or
The
it's
same
working.
civilization and species could have factions, that are rivals and bitter foes of one another. We've seen that
Right.
even just on Earth.
Yeah, just
Right,
like
exactly.
we have spies, and during a war, like if you think of it as a world war, like a interplanetary war we're going through, and we've got spies and we've got, traitors on every side of things. So yeah, of course you're going to have the same among races that, yeah, they go against the grain of the norm of the rest of them. So yeah, it's very
Maybe
interesting.
Derek, we could go through the part of the presentation where you compare the different topics and how many of these different sources, said the same exact thing, corroborating information.
Yeah,
Yeah.
that's what I was trying to get to. There's a couple slides on that. And so 8 out of 8 out of, and we've maybe talked to one or two more, but 8 out of the 8 that we've been able to get a lot of the same points across and get confirmation on, they all said that he was involved with in the secret government or the shadow government, and he was dealing with the matters of UFOs and ETs and the technology, all of them. And these are all people, they don't talk to each other. They didn't know we were gonna, ask a bunch of people. This is just them giving us information. We barely even asked questions about it. They would just start telling us this stuff.
And I think one of the most amazing ones was that Tony Rodriguez, his remote viewing team, they were just giving, it was a blind thing. They were just given a number, a 6-digit number. And I forget, it was like six or nine of nine people that remote viewed this number. And the majority of them came back with hit on all this stuff, underground bases, UFO technology, like secret societies type stuff. It was crazy. Yeah. Based on a
Yeah, it was
number.
a double blind remote viewing type of
And they weren't
thing.
talking
And
to each other either. Yeah.
yeah, Tony's perfected. He's really good at it with his team. He's been doing it for a couple of years, I think, now, and he's working on a lot of really cool stuff. But that was pretty amazing. And I think we had a, I thought I put the image of that somewhere here. Maybe not. Maybe it's in other slides. But anyway, just so many different ways of getting the information, and that it just goes to show you that there's got to be something to this. Another one that was all of them was, yeah, he had worked with the ET Advanced Tech. Yeah, at some point in his career, he'd worked directly with it. All eight said he was working on the good side with the white hats, trying to help, humanity progress in the right way and try to prevent all the secrecy and all the stuff that we're still trying to combat today. So basically, what Eisenhower tried to do, now that we know, like what he was trying to set up back then in the 50s, our grandfather probably knew about all that and was trying, also working on that side. He might have been, again, he might have been on the MJ-12 level or working directly with MJ-12 at some point. And we know that he early on, that's likely he probably had no choice. and so he probably had to go along with whatever they were telling him to do. And what that other medium said was that eventually they were basically handing him the technology to the ET tech to try to figure out how to use it. Can we use it? What should we do? Him and a couple other people. But these directors, like the MJ-12 got directors, were basically the interface between him and the ETs. And at some point they said, well, our grandfather was like, I'm not going to do this anymore unless I'm interacting directly with these things and figuring it out, because you're just getting in the way. So apparently that's how he started to interact directly with these beings and try to decipher some of this tech and see how we could use it. And again, I guess it takes a certain amount of person and maybe your DNA or genetics or whatever. How Clifford Stone says he's very empathic to these beings, and I'm sure they interact very well with some compared to other people. It just all depends on
Did your were you aware of any psi abilities or intuitive abilities that your grandfather had?
not directly, no.
Necessarily.
Not necessarily, but we knew he was into that stuff. I actually found out from buddies of ours that are about our age, and our grandfather raised him like his own sons, because he just had my mom. He didn't have any sons, and so he was basically teaching those kids early on, before they were even 10, how to shoot and how to like go. He would just say, close your eyes and envision you shooting the bullseye or shooting the middle of the target. And so they'd practice, and they'd actually do it, because they, as a kid, you don't know what the odds of that are. You're just like, okay, I'll give it a try. And so he's teaching them, you have the ability to do this. So
What
he
they
was
called
into that.
it's what they called cybernetics later, basically. But
Yeah.
please.
And I'll tell you one story about what I remember. And I asked, because he could call me the Star Child, which is kind of funny. It was a term you're throwing around back in the early 80s, when that's like, who says that? Especially when you're an old, like a grandpa, like kind of figure. But I asked my mom, why would he call me that? And she said that when I was in Ashland, and I think I kind of vaguely remember, he took me in the car, and this is when I'm like maybe 5. We just moved to Ashland, Virginia, and we'd never been in the town before, but he wants to see, he's testing me out, and he says, okay, can you tell me where the cemetery is? Or he says something about, where's the cemetery? Can show me which way direction to go. And I just start saying, okay, go here, go down here, take a right, whatever. But we end up at the cemetery. So after that, he would do things like that. He would test, he already knew we have this ability. So obviously maybe he had some of that as well, and worked on it in his early years. It's interesting. But anyway, that's just a side story.
Well, it's all part of it, because
what happened to Larry Warren in the aftermath, and others at Reynolds in the aftermath of that experience. They were being quizzed by the military and psychiatrists. Are you starting to have these psychic experiences? Are you starting to have astral dreams and what have you? And then back in 73, Lawrence Coyne, the Army Reserve helicopter pilot, and his crew, they had that close encounter with a green cylindrical craft. In the aftermath of that, they were being sent these strange questions and getting weird phone calls from people in the Pentagon asking them if they'd been having dreams about spheres and been having out-of-body experiences. So way back when they made the connection, well, certainly you go back to Maria Orsic, et cetera, and who knows before that there is some kind of psychic connection with the ETs as well as the technology itself. And a quick point, well, in the time we got left here, about Eisenhower, if your grandfather carried the football, at the very least, if you're just looking at it at a surface level, okay, that's like Atomic Energy Commission, Armed Forces Special Weapons Project, Q clearance level. But when you factor in his ET background, where he's interacting not only with the technology, but with the ET, he's been on board craft, who knows how many crash sites he'd been to, et cetera. Who better than now? Ike Eisenhower was aware of Roswell and other crash retrievals because prior to becoming president, he was chief of staff of the Army. So he definitely had a need to know. I mean, we've seen the Majestic documents where he's ordering General Nathan Twining to go to what later became Holloman Air Force Base. So at some level, Ike was cued in, but we know he didn't get the full picture until he became president, and then that was the basis for the Majestic documents to brief him in. Well, if you look at it from that standpoint, who, if you're pulling the strings at a much higher level than Ike, who better to put on his staff than your grandfather, who'd actually been on board craft, retrieved aliens, interacted with aliens? And then we now know, thanks to the work of Paul Michael Smith and others, Eisenhower definitely had encounters with ETs, not just at Muroc Field, later Edwards Air Force Base, but also in all likelihood at Holloman Air Force Base later. So, in all likelihood, if you ask me, it's possible your grandfather was part of those encounters and meetings with ETs with Ike, because if he's going to have an aide advisor with him, who better than to have your grandfather basically read him and help read him into the project too?
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I never thought
And
about that. Yeah, that's probably highly likely considering the time frame, timeline.
our grandfather says it too when he comes to these clearance levels. Like, that's the first thing he says is, out of all these clearance levels, you go up and no president's ever been cleared for that level. And he says, but Eisenhower was the closest. And that's because he probably knew firsthand Eisenhower was the closest to that.
And it's
So.
interesting also, if just going along in that vein, because, like I said, there's a lot of hullabaloo now about Dick Cheney. But if you look at who was Eisenhower's running mate and vice president, Richard Nixon, deeply, deeply involved in covert operations oversight. Richard Nixon was as a vice president. And then later on, the story emerges that he was a golfing buddy of Jackie Gleason, and he took Jackie Gleason to Homestead Air Force Base to show him alien bodies, right? So he was a vice president. He was not a vice president kept out of the loop. Clearly, he was plugged in at a very high level, along, right, joined at the hip essentially with Eisenhower.
That makes sense. I didn't realize how much Nixon was involved and that he was so interested. And obviously he's the one that spilled the beans with Gleason and that whole story, which is interesting. But Nixon was definitely interesting that he was must have been tied into high levels too. But that was the main things, like the dumps for sure, the deep underground bases, he was involved there. A lot of that came up with Tony Rodriguez. They kept seeing underground bases, they kept seeing him interacting somewhere down there at those levels.
And he mentioned that in his book too, that he had seen them, yeah, as well.
His first, and he had talked a lot with about Phil Schneider. He said, I think the first one was in, but what is it called? Bhutan or something, when they started building out these bases in the Pacific, and then, in Hawaii, and then, they just kept going and going. But he definitely knew they were all going and taking a part of that. I'm kind of just going up, and I know we don't have time to go through everything, but this was an interesting one too, Dan. I don't know if you want to mention.
I mean, so, Peter the Insider and Will Nutter had both alluded to the facts, and then one of the other channelers had alluded to the fact that Derek and I potentially had experience with the secret space program. Neither Derek or I remember any of that, but I did a QHHT session, memory regression kind of thing with Dragoor Reed. He's very, very good at it. And it was, I mean, it was very effective what he was doing. I was able to experience, past life regressions of multiple different lifetimes. And then we tried to go into the direction of asking questions about the secret space program. And it was just like there was this, it was crazy. Like I was in my regression, I was like in between lifetimes, and then just like this waveform of energy, and then there was like this steel metal plate just like blocking everything. There's no like it kind of almost just stopped the whole session when we started to get into that thing. And at one point, we tried it twice, and at one point in two different sessions, I saw myself like a flash of me like laying on a table like in a medical room, and the windows all around me, and like doctors in lab coats looking down on me, and it was just really, really weird. And then it just kind of all left. And like, yeah, my throat started to close up and like started to try to speak anything out related to it. So it was, Drago was said like it's definitely some type of attack or something, trying to stop this from happening. Whatever we're tapping into there. So that was quite an experience. I've never had anything like that happen.
Well, that makes perfect sense to me. I mean, I took one look at the both of you and I go, these guys have had experiences in their own right. You just throw off that vibe. You got that look about you energetically also. In the time we got left, I'd like your thoughts about this because we've come full circle now. Because some of the past life memories that you have or still have yet to reacquire, I'm sure you were involved in the Orion Wars and other space conflicts in our neck of the multiverse here. And so it would come as no surprise that the descendants of Daniel Salter would be inducted into this program at some level. And at some oversoul level, you two, it had been decreed at some higher cosmic level to help get this information out. Because interesting how it dovetails with the off-world secret programs. And very quickly, and I'd like your thoughts before we end the session. It's clear to me in the early days, 40s, 50s, where the Americans had to do a lot of catch-up with the Germans, what was going on in Antarctica, the aborted high jump operation down there, etc., that there was a cosmic warfare agenda on the part of at the very highest levels of the U.S. military government. And then quickly, over time, working with so-called allied nations around the world, they set up this worldwide UFO retrieval, back engineering, eventually off-world operation. And I could see from the very beginning that there was a defensive and offensive aspect to it. Because if you look back to the early players involved in this, they were all hardcore war fighters. General Curtis LeMay, arguably at that time, the greatest warrior on planet Earth, and the capability of destroying nations at a whim with the weapons he yielded with SAC and everything else. So who else better to put into that program? And then you look at some of the Manhattan Project era scientists that were known to be involved at some level in the UFO program. These people were developing like advanced weapons and detection and radar systems for the time. I think you mentioned that your dad had a background in radar as well.
Yeah, well,
No,
his specialty, our grandfather's specialty was in radar systems. That was
yeah.
his main. He was a head of the different departments of communication with the radar technology. So that was his main thing.
Well, because they found out early on that the experimental high-powered radars they had in the Southwest were knocking down these craft, which resulted in these crash retrievals. That's mentioned prominently, and even the aliens at different eras have talked about this. Herb Shermer, the patrolman that was picked up in 1968 in Nebraska, he was told by the Zeta crew, you guys got some radars that keep mucking up our navigation, causing problems for us. And even in that FBI memo, it alluded to at least three recoveries in New Mexico and the Southwest, the result of these craft being disabled by these high-powered radar systems. And you look at one of the members of the scientific team at Aztec, Dr. Merle Tuvia, I think that's how you pronounce his name, an expert at terrestrial magnetism, an expert in radar. And you have people like Louis Alvarez from the Manhattan Project and MIT Rad Lab and Berkeley Rad Lab, an expert in experimental physicists as well as an expert in radar. So at an early age, they were getting these people, LeMay, Tuvia, Louis Alvarez, and others. And they were gearing up for some kind of not just war with the Soviets, but they were preparing for some kind of like cosmic war. And this was alluded to in Philip Corso's book and his testimony as well. But just your thoughts, come full circle. You talked about the secret space program a moment ago. Where do you see all this headed? Because, we may be, I've had many dreams of full-on, all-out alien invasions in the past. I mean, that could be, in the cards. You never know. So I'd like your thoughts on this. Never mind the fact that we're already under alien occupation anyway, if you ask me, the reptilian overlordship and all. But please, in the time you got left, you've got the floor.
You go ahead first, Dan.
Well, I mean, what you described makes total sense. Our grandfather talked about, our radars interfering with their technology in his book as well. And he was, we have his, from the Freedom Disclosure Act with, from the U.S. Air Force, we have all the documentation that he was a radar specialist. That was his expertise. He was a director of the divisions. So that aligns a lot, makes a lot of sense.
Even called
He
it the
talks
Mars
about,
Division. But, yeah.
they had a program called Mars, the Mars program that he was in charge of that didn't stand for, supposedly didn't stand for anything that had to do with extraterrestrials. But he talks about, in his book, us trying to put nuclear weapons in space and on the moon and things like this, and how we've been stopped every time by the extraterrestrials. They don't want any of that. He said that we've had warnings from them about using atomic weapons and how we're not just, destroying the Earth, we're destroying other dimensions when we do that, and the massive effects that they don't want that happening in our solar system, in our universe. And so for the most part, his view was that there's a lot of oversight on our planet, from a benevolent standpoint, that they aren't going to let us get too out of control and let us destroy ourselves, essentially. That they're kind of monitoring, and there was not a lot of his. I think his main message was, it was more of a kind of like a spiritual uplifting kind of direction for humanity, with respect to coming into this knowledge and this disclosure. And that's why he wanted to push it so much, because there could be a lot of amazing things that can happen when people have access to these things. So his perspective was much more of a positive one, I would say, for the future.
That's great. Derek, any last thoughts?
I totally agree with that. I mean, that's really what he wanted. He didn't want to scare people. I mean, there's a lot of scary things out in the world besides just the fact that ETs are here. Or it could be have been in control and subversively controlling and things like that. I think all of that goes to say, but the human factor has always been the factor that decides that. It's not them, it's us. I mean, otherwise we wouldn't be here right now. There's a reason why we're still standing and we're still here. It's because we're valuable, regardless if we're talking about benevolent or malevolent ETs. We're valuable to them either way. So we have to stand up and say, okay, we're taking our power back, and we no longer agree. We know we break all contracts, we break all ties that we once had, and we do not no longer basically accept what those people on the highest secret societies or whatever have been doing, and the Illuminati leaders or whatever you want to call it, these elites. And they just assume that we're all cattle and we'll just just go off and mindlessly,
Slaughterhouse, yeah. No, and it could
Yeah,
happen.
exactly. All that's going away now, and we're taking. He was all about promoting, to do your own research, to think for yourself. No matter what he had to say, you have the power to, and your own power. And you have all this information within you. It's in our genes, in our DNA. We just have to reclaim it. So he did. He was a proponent of that. He was very spiritual towards the end of his life. He was always philosophical. He got a PhD, I believe, in philosophy. We didn't realize that, but he went to school in the 70s for that purpose, probably because of all the stuff he saw. How else do you handle all you've been dealt with as even in your 20s and early as a young adult? You're seeing so much and trying to take it all in. Of course, you're going to be very philosophical and think about God and spirituality and
And one of
also
the
be.
papers he wrote, we found in storage. Sorry to interrupt. One of the papers we found in his storage thing was he like how to, what an alien government would look like, and he had like all every facet of the government laid out, like what the Constitution would look like and how the laws would be, and like it was pretty amazing. And it was just for this school paper thing that he was doing for his philosophy thing, but it was very detailed. It's like, okay,
Yeah.
where do you come up with some of this stuff, right?
At an oversoul level, he probably remembers in some way. My mentor, Barbara Bartholuk, always told me the reason, we feel so bad, from an empathic standpoint about everything that's going on here is because originally we're not from this place. We're from a more spiritually highly evolved society and civilization where this stuff is just unthinkable. So when we come into this density, this plane of existence on Earth, and have to deal with all this, it's a shock to the system, like jumping into a cold swimming pool,
Right.
and a quick point, and then we can sign off. Love to have you guys back again. The warnings that the various ET groups, and I've always said this over and over again, the 1940s, 50s, 60s contactee era has to be reevaluated. Too many of these NICAP, MUFON, other type investigators just poo-pooed. Oh yeah, people having encounters with perfectly human-looking aliens and being taken for joy rides around the atmosphere and the other worlds. Yeah, that's nonsense. That's a distraction from the real nuts and bolts, lights in the sky stuff, right? But if you look back at a lot of those contactee cases, that was the same message that these human and other types of aliens were telling people. It's when you, and if you look at the mind-numbing amount of atmospheric and underground nuclear tests and thermonuclear tests we've had on this planet. And when the
Right.
ETs were saying, every time you detonate one of these things, not only do you mess up your own world, but it's having a negative impact in other dimensions and other realms, even. And
Of
so they have
course.
a vested interest in not allowing like World War III with nukes to cook off. And when you look at the surveillance exerted by various ET civilizations over the nuclear weapons of mass destruction arsenals of Earth, with them shutting down nuclear missile silos, etc. Clearly, there is a faction or factions of ETs that don't want us to have nuclear weapons and certainly not to use them because of the potential negative impact it'll have on their worlds and
Right.
nothing else. And a quick final point. You alluded earlier to Star Wars, the Strategic Defense Initiative. I've always thought that that was a cover for some kind of space-based weapon system, either offensive slash defensive against aliens,
Yes.
and that certain alien races didn't like it. This is why so many of
Yes.
these scientists and technicians in Marconi in Great Britain were like dying or having accidents and having suicides. But you guys got the last word.
But that's why I brought up to this slide, because he mentions this Star Wars Defense Initiative and all that. And he actually, this is important to note. Our mom and our grandma both worked at NASA during the Apollo moon landings. They were there, and my mom's like, oh, my grandma just knew somebody, and that's how they got there. I don't buy that. There's a reason they were working there, and they got their jobs. And our grandfather retired 68. They lived in Houston. They're from Houston. He wanted to travel and figure out where else in the U.S. they were going to move to. But after 6 months of traveling around, he ends up back in Houston, and he's there. I know he's there for a reason. He wants to be there during these moon landings, and of course, NROs going out on in the background while NASA's taking place. Well, now he's part of NRO, and he's part of, just like you said, they've got millions and millions of dollars being funded into this space-based, defense initiative and all those other things. So I'm sure he was there for a reason also, in that regard. It's just, that's a whole nother can of worms to think about. But so many things happening. For sure. And I think that's so naive for us today to be like, oh my gosh, they're trying to take out our nuclear silos. They don't want us to use our missiles. They're a threat. No, they're trying to save us and everyone else in the universe from, completely being destroyed in other dimensions. We got to think a little bit bigger outside the box,
We
I think.
do, because if you look at what's happened just in our solar system, which the ETs will be well aware of, we had a formerly very large planet, call it Tiamat, call it Maldek, whatever, got blown to pieces, turned into the asteroid belt. We have Dr. John Brandenberger, I think his name is. He's proven scientifically that two huge thermonuclear airbursts over Mars wiped out large swaths of whatever surface population was there, right? And those the people on the surface could have just been collateral damage. They could have been trying to get somebody underground or something. You don't know. You know what I mean? I mean, these aliens, especially the malevolent ones, they play high stakes poker, right? So we have to be able to zoom out and think at a cosmic level. There are forces that don't want all this to happen, and there are forces that do want this to happen. I'm talking non-human forces. So anyway, you've really given myself and our viewers and listeners a lot to think about. Thank you so much for the work you guys do, Daniel and Derek. It was a pleasure meeting you, and it's a pleasure getting to know you going forward.
Yeah, it was
Yeah.
great. Thanks so much for having us. Yeah.
Yeah, glad to be here. Thank you so much for your time. Yeah.
We'll definitely do it again. We'd love to come back. So, yeah,
Absolutely. And
thank
I'd
you.
love to come on to your show again too. And to
Please.
our dear listeners out there, wherever you may be, whatever you may be doing, have a very pleasant time, and we'll see you next time. Bye for now.